We have almost allowed sin to disappear from our vocabularies. The larger framework of what we're doing tonight is a look at some of the Psalms. A couple of weeks ago, I told you that we were going to spend some Sunday nights. They're not going to be consecutive Sunday nights. They haven't been, and they won't be for the next two or three weeks because of this or that interruption. But on Sunday nights, we're going to be looking at some chosen Psalms. Seems to me that if we get so much good from Psalm 1 and Psalm 23 and Psalm 51, there just must be other Psalms in this collection of 150 that have a great deal to say to our lives today. We're going to try to pull out some of those and look at them rather carefully. In Matthew 1, verse 21, when Mary was with child and Joseph knew he was not the father of it, was about ready to put her away privately, the angel said, "She shall bear a son, and you shall call his name Jesus, for he shall save his people from their sins." That's the kind of text I heard a great deal when I was young, and I expect you heard it a lot in past years, but it sounds almost quaint today. The extent to which it sounds quaint is the motivation for this sermon tonight. We have all but let sin go out of the vocabulary. We explain man's problems in virtually every other way. It isn't popular or common nowadays to talk of man as a moral creature. It's more common to talk of man as evolving in his own self-made direction, perhaps being on some kind of automatic escalator that's taking him to higher and higher heights. But we don't think of man being in a moral universe under moral law, at least much of our world doesn't, with inevitable relationships, not only to other people, but to God. But the Bible's point of view is that man is in relationship to God as well as to other people, and that it's the care for or neglect for that relationship to God that spoils or blesses his relationships to other people. We explain his miseries in lots of other ways instead of explaining them by sin. If we're educators, we tend to say man's basic, his critically central problem is ignorance. And what he really needs most of all is education. If we're psychologists, we say man's critically central problem is that he doesn't have an integrated, mature personality. And what he really needs is therapy. If we're social reformers, we tend to say man's critically central problem, the thing that bothers human beings most, is his environment. And the real treatment is an improvement of that environment. If we're political activists, we tend to say man's critically central problem is that he doesn't have any power to change the things that need to be changed. And the treatment is power to the people. And of course, if we're dialectical materialists, we explain that man's critically central problem is a lopsided distribution of capital. And the treatment is a restoration of capital to all the people in an even fashion, and on and on. But whatever our explanation is, it isn't apt to be that man's critically central problem is sin. I'm not at all going to indicate that the things I've talked about are not problems. All of us, in one way or another, are probably trying to make some contribution toward the alleviation of one or more of those problems. I believe that much of man's problem is ignorance, a lack of an integrated personality, the environment with which he's surrounded, a lopsided distribution of capital that sometimes doesn't give him a chance to get going, and so on. But the key words are those words, critically central. What is the real issue with man's problems? That critically central thing, according to the Bible, is sin. Now, over against that, I have the impression that we welcome its disappearance. We don't really care that we don't any longer hear the hellfire and brimstone type sermon. I don't know a shorter cut toward a description of it. But the kind that, with multiplied illustrations, often frighten people into a response. I happen not to think that all of that was gospel preaching. Hell is a message taught in the Bible, but an awful lot of the emotional stirring and restirring and preying on human emotion is not necessarily a biblical approach. But at the same time, going completely away and forgetting to use sin or its inevitable punishment, its eternal punishment, as a category of our thinking, is just as great a mistake. If we shelter our feelings and our sensibilities to the point that we can look back on those poor people in the medieval church who were constantly told about Dante's divine inferno and all the descriptions of sin and its punishment, its degrees of treatment, if we're so glad to be rid of that, that we quit using sin as a category of human experience, we become unbiblical. You've seen, perhaps, the movie, The Brothers Karamazov, or you've read the novel. Many of you have, I'm sure. You know the chapter on the Grand Inquisitor. It was the day of the Inquisition. It was riding hard on Europe. Anybody who tried to bring about a change in the tradition of his day was a heretic, and he had to be dealt with. Heresy was not only to be ferreted out, heretics were to be ferreted out. One by one, people were brought before the Grand Inquisitor and dealt with until, in Dostoevsky's story, Jesus Christ, who had come back to earth to see how the faith he'd planted was doing, was brought in before the Grand Inquisitor. And when what he stood for was made clear, he was judged a heretic. And finally, in the story, executed, because he was subversive to the faith of the church. But it was one way of saying for one man that we become so satisfied with things around us, so warped in our understanding of sin, that the biblical approach is foreign to us, that we don't get back to it and discover it for ourselves. Well, that time of the Grand Inquisitor, that time the medieval church and its list of seven deadly sins, is a long time ago. We've come a long way, in the words of the commercial. To go back and talk about sin is sort of like going back and talking about running boards on cars and kerosene lamps and one-room schoolhouses and unfluoridated water and all sorts of other things that came before the modern era. And yet here is a topic that was so real it just permeates the 14th Psalm. If you know the Psalms very well, you probably know something else. The 14th Psalm and the 53rd Psalm are almost identical in words. Lots of people have wondered and do wonder about that. And there's no way to give a final explanation. One of the differences is that the 14th Psalm uses the word Jehovah to describe God, and the 53rd uses the word Elohim, or God. It's translated as God's name. And so some explain that one is the Psalm for the covenant people Israel, the covenant name of God being Jehovah, and the other is the same psalm applied universally. Perhaps two collections of inspired psalms, and one written with the word Elohim, the other with the word Yahweh or Jehovah in it. Others see it as a kind of universalizing of sin, whereas Jehovah, or the one which uses his name, is written directly to Israel, the other is addressed to all men, saying, all of you are sinners. But the psalm is repeated almost verbatim. And it begins with a problem the psalmist found in Israel. The fool says in his heart, there's no God. He is meeting practical atheism. It must have been a fairly widespread problem, else he would likely not have treated it in a psalm with such detail as he does. The words of the psalm get picked up by Paul in the book of Romans, chapter 3, verses 10 to 12. If you'll try to recall the text that was read, you'll recognize the words here. As is written, none is righteous, no, not one. No one understands, no one seeks for God. All have turned aside, together they've gone wrong. No one does good, not even one. That's Paul's reflection back. It's in a chapter where he's describing the universal sinfulness of man. Romans 1 is devoted to the sinfulness of the pagans, the Gentiles, without the law. Romans 2, the sinfulness of the Jews who had the law. And Romans 3 says all have sinned and come short of God's glory, but Paul wants to say it in the most vivid words possible. And so he reaches back to Psalm 14 and quotes the words. A day of practical atheism. I mean by practical atheism that I don't see any evidence in Psalm 14 or Psalm 53 that this man has gone through elaborate argumentation to deny the existence of God. It appears from the psalm that he's a moral fool, a moral atheist. No God for me. Not so much a denial that it's impossible that God should exist as a denial that he wants anything to do with God in his own life. And so the writer begins to describe where this leads, and he gives about three steps. In the first verse he says, they are corrupt, they do abominable deeds, there's none that does good. That's the first step in practical atheism. When a person quits keeping his relationship with God, the things he once would not have mentioned, he soon finds himself doing. The man who says, no God for me, becomes corrupt. He does abominable things. The second step is described in verse 3 when he says, they've all gone astray, they're all alike corrupt, or the King James Version has it, filthy. There's none that does good, no, not one. They're not only poisoned in their own minds, they've started doing filthy things. When one poisons his relationship to God by denying God a place in his life, it isn't long till he fails to respect the rights of other people. It is not a terribly long way from a denial that God has anything to do with my life to the gas chambers of Auschwitz or somewhere else. It isn't a terribly long distance from corrupting one's own soul by separation from God to a filthy treatment of other people. And that's what the psalmist is outlining. And finally he says in verse 5, there they shall be in great terror, for God is with the generation of the righteous. Great fear, the King James Version says. But the great terror the translations try to bring out is literally, there they shall be in fear of fear. It's the Hebrew way of doubling a thing. In fear of fear, great terror. Sort of reminiscent of Roosevelt's words, we've nothing to fear but fear itself. Which was a fairly real thing when he said it, and it is now. Men become so terrorized in their wrongs, their inability to care for themselves, we become afraid of fear itself. The extent to which this leads is, I think, most poignantly put in verse 4. Have they no knowledge, all the evildoers, who eat up my people as they eat bread? That appetite of iniquity, that devouring appetite of the evildoer and of sin, is the thing really being underlined by the psalm. In the rural area, when I was a child, there were all sorts of riddles, little conundrums, and you were supposed to figure out the meaning. What is it that eats everything before it and always wants more? The obvious answer was the threshing machine. But I suppose if you were reading Psalm 14, you'd say sin, iniquity. That's what the writer is saying. It just devours everything before it and always wants more to devour. It's never satisfied. And that's the theme of Psalm 14. That once you say, no God for me, you have no other defense against evil. And you are going to be devoured completely by it. We may put that in all sorts of words. The psalm ends with a kind of messianic hope. A long-range hope that one day God is going to give deliverance. But the gist of the psalm is that when one says, I'll have nothing to do with God, he's only a step from an insatiable appetite for sin. And it keeps on leading him until he is finally in terror of terror itself. Now, if that's true, our disposition to dismiss sin from our vocabularies is a very unhealthy thing. If sin is that grave, that serious, then our trying to get rid of it but just not talking about it isn't going to work very well. Now you probably know without my telling you that there are an awful lot of other writers beside the psalmist, beside Paul and Romans who deal with sin. Religious writers in the tradition of the Bible, that is, with the Bible as their background, like a Dante with his Inferno, have often been somewhat obsessed by sin. The medieval writers in the church were. When Martin Luther stood at this end of the medieval period, he still could quote an early Latin writer with complete approval who said, the spirit of man is compassed about and besieged by the assaults of the devil and can hardly withstand them all. If avarice is overthrown, lust rises. If lust is put down, ambition takes its place. If ambition is displaced, then anger grows bitter. Pride puffs itself up. Drunkenness assails. Hatred breaks the bonds of discord. Envy destroys friendship. Well, that early writer, past biblical times, is simply saying as he observes man, when you put one sin down, another comes up. That's what the medieval people meant by drawing up their list of pride, envy, anger, lust, sloth, avarice, adultery, gluttony, seven deadly sins. Put one down, another pops up somewhere else. Man is surrounded by sin. Now, maybe I'm talking about something unrealistic. You don't really think of your problem as ignorance. If you just knew better, you'd do better. Or you don't really think in terms of, if I could just clean up the environment, I'd be so much better person, or the world would be so much better. But all I'm pleading for is that if Psalm 14 is going to be taken seriously, we're going to have to make sin a real part not only of our vocabulary, but of our thinking. It isn't just biblical writers and those who have learned something from the Bible who talk this way. If you go into the Greek writers, they do the same thing. I don't know those writers as well, but I've read a good bit about them and some in them. You know that a writer like Sophocles in his play about Oedipus reflects the typical Greek spirit that sin is personified as the Furies. And the Furies are always haunting men. They're tempting them. The sailors can't sail by any shore without the Furies trying to lure them onto the shore where they'll be perhaps destroyed and shipwrecked, made captive to evil. And those Furies keep on haunting a man, not only till death, but after death, to try to keep him out of those Elysian fields, because that's where he'd find peace and happiness. But it's the Greek tragedy writer's way of trying to say, man never gets loose. Sin is always very near. Sophocles ended that play, therefore, O man, beware, and look toward the end of things that be, the last of sights, the last of days, and no man's life account as gain, ere the full tale be finished, and the darkness find him without pain. Don't ever be sure. Till the full tale is over, and he goes into the darkness and has no pain, you're never sure that he has escaped the Furies. Well, you know what Shakespeare could do with a thing like that. Think of any play of his you had to meet in school. Othello, Macbeth, Hamlet, Caesar. Think of those characters like Brutus, Mark Antony. You have character after character in whose life you see sin take hold and keep working itself out into a more and more bitter climax, because that's the way Shakespeare saw human character being driven. Or think of Milton, who has Satan take the final step. So fond is he of sin that he wants sin to be good. And so he says, evil be thou my good. Milton's way of trying to be as vivid as possible and say, the last step sin wants to take is for people to think sin is good. Vice is virtue. It's an old problem we're working with. The thing that seems so new when it meets you tomorrow morning has been meeting people a very long time. It's a grave thing. That's what Psalm 14 is saying, and it's what the other writers are saying. Sin is real in life. Now, there are two or three reasons why I think it's important that we just realize that fundamental fact and know the passage of Scripture which underlines it in terse words. One of those reasons is that I don't think you can understand life, your own or anybody else's, without taking sin seriously. The earlier writers we've talked about may have overlooked some things about man, but they never overlooked the fact of sin, and they had a great deal of understanding of man. It may seem to us that a biblical writer didn't know as much psychology as he should have, or he would have done this or that, but he knew about sin and the kind of problem it was to the human being, and he treated it. And unless we have an understanding of what sin does in lives, there's no way for us to really understand why we do the things we do. We find ourselves with Paul, Romans 7. Wretched man that I am, who will deliver me from this body of death? What I would, I do not. What I would not, that I do. In recent years, a vast study of biblical words has been undertaken a bunch of German scholars have led, and they've produced what's called Theological Word Book of the New Testament, and now one of the Old Testament. Sort of a monument in scholarship of these ancient languages and biblical words. And when the writer in the series deals with sin, he says, this is the fact which, along with human creatureliness, explains the nature of the world. I don't think he missed it. The fact that you and I are creatures and we have fallen into sin explains the way life is. To be specific, I can't understand my own life and you can't understand yours till you begin coping with the pride in your life. The tendency to deify yourself, to make your own way right, and question everybody else's approach. I don't mean to set aside the standard where the standard is spoken, but I mean that justification of conduct where one is just so sure he's following the standard without ever re-examining it. What do you think those Jews thought when they stoned the prophets to death? We're getting rid of God's men? I doubt it. I think they thought, here are some men who are saying hard words, and they don't fit with what we've traditionally done at the temple. Death. What do you think those Jewish men thought when they brought that woman taken in adultery into the presence of Jesus Christ? We're as sinful as she is, but she deserves to be dealt with. We're exempt. I doubt it. They thought, rather, here's a blatant case. At least we sort of cover our wrongs. Surely we're not that bad. What did Saul think when he held the garments of those who stoned Stephen to death? I'm going to kill one of God's men? Of course not. There was a kind of pride shot through it all. I've been keeping the law all these years, and here's a man preaching something other than the law, and he's got to be dealt with. Pride. It's awfully hard for us to see through our wrongdoing when pride gets in the way. And so Proverbs 16:18 says, pride goes before destruction and a haughty spirit before a fall. When Carlyle looked at man, he came out with a very pessimistic view of human nature. And he dealt with pride, greed. He figured if you gave a slave half the world, thinking if I give him things, it'll make him happy, you'd make him the most miserable person in the world because he'd grieve himself to death that he didn't have the other half. And he was about right. A desire for possession is not bad, but when I decide I'm accountable to no one but myself, not even the God, and I want more, that's greed, avarice. Like the Kansas farmer who was charged with somebody with being greedy because he had large holdings and wanted more. He said, I'm not greedy, I just want all the land that borders on mine. That gets to be a lot of land. But somehow we turn ourselves loose in pride and we're going to exalt ourselves. There are prejudices. The way we treat other people. Just categorize everybody in a lump. They're Orientals, we've nothing to do with them. Or a kind of superiority in our own accomplishments. I can learn and they can't. Our passion. Those heated moments when we're determined to have our way and wipe out whoever stands in the way. I talked this morning for a moment about sexual license and the way it's had such a bearing on some of the disbelief or unbelief that's claimed in our century. Aldous Huxley, one of the famous Huxley family, which for generations has been famous for its unbelief, admitted late in life that this philosophy of meaninglessness, the whole world means nothing, everything's empty, he and his fellows had arrived at because they wanted liberty, license, particularly sexual liberty. And the best way they could find to revolt was to question whether anything in life had any real meaning or not. Our passions. I suppose it reads all right, very attractively, in Lady Chatterley's Lover. But when you pick up this morning's paper and find the lady who was abused and perhaps killed last night, it isn't very attractive. May draw large crowds when it's rated X at the movie screen. But when it results in murder and perversion, it isn't so attractive anymore. You can't understand life, your own or anybody else's, without understanding sin. We can say it's our environment, things around us press us into wrongdoing, anything we wish. You and I know we could be better than we are. we aren't really working at our own problems as we ought. There's a second reason we need to keep sin in our vocabulary. And that is that if we don't have it, we tend to divide up into camps and harden ourselves against one another because we see no possibility that we could be wrong. The other fellow always has to be wrong. It's only when I'm willing to confess my own sins, I might be wrong, but there's a little pliability in me, and you and I have a chance of getting together if we're apart. There are a lot of scapegoats. We can always blame someone else for our wrongdoing. But sin helps us to fix it where it belongs. It's my failure that put me where I am. It's easy enough to explain all the crime in the daily papers by saying these people are in poverty. These don't have any power. Those live in slums. Conditions may be very bad, but we're not fatalists. Every man has the ability to rise. He has an ability to strive toward the good. That's a basic Christian principle. And unless it's called sin, we're not going to understand it. There's a final reason. We're not going to understand life unless we keep it as a category of understanding. We're going to harden ourselves and never be willing to be reconciled to the other person if we don't see the possibility of sin in our lives. Think of all the excitement of the gospel you miss if you don't take sin seriously. So good you don't need it. Fine fellow without the Lord. I remind you of the New Testament text tonight. For he shall save his people from their sins. He was not an option given to us by God to round out the good religious experience man had developed on his own, or even the good experience of the law. He was a necessity. He came to save his people from their sins. Until we see ourselves as sinners, we miss the excitement people sensed when they were around Jesus. Read the Gospels afresh. See the people he touched, the people who heard him, and the exuberance of spirit they had, the happiness, the joy, as they ran and told other people what had happened. We miss that joy because we haven't felt that pain. Whatever happened to sin? Whatever happened to the understanding of our own shortcomings before God that put us where we are, that made us need the change the Lord Jesus Christ provides? But I'd like to be a little more personal as we close. Not just whatever happened to sin, but whatever happened to yours. Whatever happened to your sin is part of the message of the gospel. You may have learned to rationalize it, blame it on somebody else. You may have become accustomed to it so it doesn't bother you anymore. But there's a more effective way of dealing with it. You shall call his name Jesus, for he shall save his people from their sins. Psalm 14 is a picture of where man goes in practical atheism, and the world is full of it, just full of it. No God for me. I'm living very well without him. But that leads to corruption and filth and eventual terror, the psalmist says. And the way back is through obedience to Christ. Would you start back while we sing?